So we conclude this hour with a reporter's notebook debrief from a dear friend of this program. For the past 4 years, Ethan Bronner has been stationed in Israel as the Jerusalem bureau chief for our partner, the New York Times. He's right here in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John.
Welcome to the studio. And thanks so much for all of your fine work over the past 4 years.
That's very kind of you to say.
You began in Jerusalem about the time this program went on the air. And, you know, both of us in our assignments here, all of us in our assignments here span an important set of changes in history. Let me just begin by asking you something of a personal question. I was in the Middle East during the Tom Friedman years, based in Jerusalem for NPR. And it's extraordinary, the difference between the New York Times Jerusalem bureau chief and almost any other reporter in the region. Do you think there's a position in journalism where your every word is more closely watched by Americans, Israelis, politicians in the Arab world, politicians around the world than the Jerusalem bureau chief position for the New York Times?
I think not. I think you're hitting on something which is absolutely true. And I think it's even truer today than when Tom was there and when you were there. And I was there, by the way, briefly in those years for Reuters. The thing that's, I think that part of the problem is that there's just so much contention over every element of this conflict. But I also have the notion that, assuming I'm right, that it's gotten worse. It's because the conflict and attempts to resolve it have gotten stuck. And so the feeling I have is that all the energy that's generally directed at the conflict itself is now directed only at the description and narration of the conflict. And so... And, of course, it's true that the New York Times position is the one most watched. I mean, I must say, I think that is even truer today than it was 10 or 20 years ago. I think the Washington Post and L.A. Times, you know, their role in national discourse has declined slightly, and the Times is one has stayed or risen. And so there's just an incredible focus on what's written there.
We might come back to that in a moment, but let's begin by giving people a sense of the change that's taken place over the last 4 years. And when I left the Middle East, there was all kinds of energy in the other direction. There was momentum for peace. There was, you know, Yitzhak Rabin and PLO chief Yasser Arafat shaking hands at the White House. It couldn't be more different. Here's a clip at the end of 2008 from you talking to us about the situation in Gaza, with Hamas really declaring war on the people of Israel around the Gaza border.
They particularly point to the fact that Hamas decided not to renew the ceasefire it had with Israel after the 18th or 19th of December, despite Egypt and Israel asking for it, the sense that Hamas felt it could continue to lob rockets with impunity.
Now, that was the situation pretty much that dominated the beginning of your stay in Jerusalem. How did you find that conflict, and how do you think it's proceeded since?
Well, the Gaza question is somewhat sui generis, but generally, the point you made in the beginning of your question, it couldn't be more appropriate, which is that one of the things that characterized the Israeli-Palestinian conflict beginning in the late 80s was an attempt to understand one another, at least at a moderate level. I don't think both societies were deeply involved in it, but important segments of the elite and even somewhat deeper than that on both sides. And, you know, in those days when you were there and in the 90s, there were tens of thousands, more than 100,000 Palestinians working in Israel. Obviously, it was a relationship of unequals, a semi-colonial relationship, if you like. But there were a number of personal interactions, a lot. If you were a Palestinian working in Israel and your kid got married, you invited your Israeli colleague and that colleague went. And at that time, there was no Jazeera, no Arabiya, no Manad. There were no satellite stations that allowed Palestinians to be part of the larger Arab world. In those days, they watched Israeli television, listened to Israeli radio. So the result was that Israelis and Palestinians began to get to know one another. Today, they have almost no interaction at all, and they have nothing but contempt increasingly for one another.
And you describe how there's been a real sense of Israel turning in on itself in the midst of the Arab Spring. Here are you talking about how the Arab Spring has really transformed both Israeli politics and the sort of day-to-day culture inside Israel.
The hawkish government of Benjamin Netanyahu is entrenching its sense of the need to focus largely on security for Israel and less on cutting a deal and making concessions to the Palestinians. The feeling they have is that if Egypt can go, well, you know, everything is at risk and we need to
preserve what we have and not start giving away land and security positions.
Ethan Bronner, what was it like to feel those transformations in day-to-day Israeli society? Because, you know, the Israelis consider themselves a cosmopolitan people. They travel a lot. They go all over the world. So this sense of isolation, how did it bear on conversations and the sense of personal identity among the people that you interacted with?
That's a great question, John. I mean, there's a sort of implicit in your question is that there was a great turning inward, and indeed that's true. But the sort of global economy that has coincided with this period of failure of Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking has actually created a whole set of pathways for Israelis to ignore what's going on around them, not face it anyway, not deal with it, and yet be part of the larger world. In some ways, Israel has never been a more cosmopolitan, more open, more involved place with the world than it is today. And that is part of this sad set of ironies that's occurring, which is that as a result of the Arab Spring, Palestinians are turning to their region and trying to figure out how they might fit into that. As a result of the global economy and the Arab Spring, Israelis are looking sort of over the horizon to Europe, Asia, and the United States and trying to figure out how they fit in there. And they are simply ignoring one another. And there is this terrible sense of a ticking clock.
What is the Palestinian view of the Arab Spring as that developed? A sense of surprise, shock, a sense of we're ahead of the Egyptians, or we wish we were ahead of the Egyptians?
It's very confused, and your question is, again, great. You know, on the one hand, Palestinians say to themselves, we were the ones who created this. We got here first, and they're following us. On the other hand, they are used to being at the core of Arab discourse in the world, and they're looking around and saying, why isn't everyone talking about us the way they used to? They're worried about their own problems, and the Israelis continue to build settlements and all those sorts of things, and we are orphaned, in fact. So it's been a very difficult period for them.
Let's look at the politics in Israel. Benjamin Netanyahu, the head of the Likud party and the leader of Israel right now, announcing that elections will be held a year early, possibly anticipating a sense of bolstering domestic political strength to confront or face what may be a stronger incumbent U.S. president if Barack Obama gets reelected, or a newly elected Mitt Romney, depending on the outcome of the U.S. election. How important is this relationship to Benjamin Netanyahu?
Obviously, it's very important. I think the question of why he called an early election is also complicated. I mean, the explanation you offered is one, but I think if there hadn't been agitation from his coalition partners, Lieberman's party and the far further right parties, I think that Netanyahu would have been happy to actually live out his term. He is facing a bunch of things. There's an ultra-Orthodox service in the army law. There's a budget issue. There's a bunch of things coming this summer, as well as fear of social protests that make him feel that if everyone's yelling at me to have elections, fine, we'll hold elections right now, and I'm going to really win, and he probably will.
What has this taught you as a reporter? If you go online and look at tweets, and if you Google Ethan Bronner, and you look at various sides of this conflict, and just look at what's said about you, what has it been like to have every conflict of interest accusation be thrown your way? You do this, you act this way, you do this with your family in Israel, and all of a sudden, everything that you say about the conflict is suspect.
Well, I would be lying if I didn't tell you it wasn't painful. It is painful to be under attack a lot. On the other hand, I do I believe very deeply in what we do, which is the journalism, which is an attempt to step back from whatever personal, tribal, religious, familial affiliations you have, and to try to seek truth and tell it, describe it with sophistication and without personal engagement of your own background. That is, I believe, what we're supposed to do, and I think it's a very important thing to do. Obviously, it's like being objective, quote-unquote. It's like being a judge in a court. It is a goal that you seek. But I think the most important thing is that we continue to seek that goal rather than the sort of implicit assumption of a lot of the attacks, which is that it's all advocacy. It's all about who you are and what you believe, and journalism is just a kind of patina to pretend that you're doing something else. And I reject that entirely. You know, to me, in that sense, the battle has to be continued to be fought.
Ethan Bronner, for 4 years, the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. You're going to be a restaurant critic now? A little less pressure?
I'm going to be a national legal correspondent.
All right.
So.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.